Good morning. I too want to greet you all in Jesus' name and welcome each one here to the service this morning. Various parts of the service this morning have blended or overlapped, dovetailed with at least some of the thoughts that I have this morning. It's hard to believe in some ways that we are at July 1. We are halfway through 2018. The year is half gone. And that is always amazing how quickly time goes. And it seems like this time of the year, which I love this time of the year, I love the activity, the company, the visitors, and all that's going on, that deep within, I always know that it's passing so quickly. And it always is over, and getting ready for school happens so quickly. And like the passage that I will read in a little bit, it says that life is like a vapor. And we want to think about that for part of the morning this morning. I hope you're not tired of the book of James yet, but I'm committed to following through with that. And this morning I want to continue that. The last message, some of you would not have been here, but was the first part of the book of James, chapter 4. And we focused on the aspect of the friendship of the world. The friendship of the world and how Satan and the world system is the enemy of God. And how God's heart is broken when His bride, us as a church, or us as individuals, are lured away from Him and into an adulterous relationship of the world around us. Today I want to look at the last part of the chapter of chapter 4. And I too want to say, and I mean, that I feel that as I preach these things this morning, that I am not one that has attained, but I am rather reaching forth to these things. And I'm on a journey with the rest of you. I don't want to come across in any way that I'm different, elevated, no more, because I don't. It's hard to know where to always break in here and how much attention to give to what portions here that James has this morning, or as we go through this. But this morning I want to start, I guess I'll break in, I know it's breaking in, at verse 10. It's kind of in the middle of a thought, but I want to capture at least the last part of this thought that he finishes here in verse 10, and then I'll read to the end of the chapter. So I'll read that at this time. James chapter 4, verse 10. It says, "Humble yourselves in the sight of the Lord, and He shall lift you up. Speak not evil one of another, brethren. He that speaketh evil of his brother and judgeth his brother, speaketh evil of the law, and judgeth the law. But if thou judge the law, thou art not a doer of the law, but a judge. There is one lawgiver, who is able to save and to destroy. Who art thou that judgest another? Go to now, ye that say, today or tomorrow, we will go into such a city, and continue there a year, and buy, and sell, and get gain. Whereas ye know not what shall be on the morrow. For what is your life? It is even a vapor that appeareth for a little time, and then vanisheth away. For that ye ought to say, if the Lord will, we shall live and do this or that. But now ye rejoice in your boastings, and all such rejoicing is evil. Therefore to him that knoweth to do good, and doeth it not, to him it is sin." The first thing I want to think about just for a little bit here this morning is in verse 10, is this thought of humility, humble, being humble. Humble yourselves, it says. And I think what James is saying here, the thought that he is giving, is that humility is a personal choice. It is something that I must consciously choose to do. It is not something that just happens to us. It is not something that we are just born with by nature. How do we do this? How do we go about, how do we start to humble ourselves? And I think there's a lot of wrong concepts about humility that come into our hearts. And humility is not attained by outward and external things. It is not attained by the circumstances that come upon my life. It isn't by the kind of car that we drive, if we drive an old dented car, or by living in a rundown house, or the clothes that we wear, if we wear dirty, ill-fitting clothes. That is not how we humble ourselves. Humility and pride certainly do affect the things that we wear and do and drive and the external things that we handle in life. It is definitely a fruit of the condition of the heart. It will impact those things. We do not become humble by being persecuted or mocked, ridiculed. We do not necessarily become humble by hard knocks in life, difficulties that put us down, by going broke or getting sick. The process of humility cannot be by someone else upon our lives. You know, someone can humiliate me. Someone can make me feel small, but they cannot humble me. And sometimes in our human hearts, we see someone we perceive as proud, arrogant, needs knocked down a notch or two, and we go about that possibly, or at least in our hearts, we hope that somehow that happens. And maybe sometimes people want to do that to us when they see that we're proud. But the problem is with that, is that those things do not make us humble. In fact, usually it just hurts our pride a little bit more when someone tries to humble us. True humility is a choice that you and I must make. It is a decision about how we are going to think about ourselves. It's simply thinking accurately is actually what it is. Accurately about who I really am. And an attitude and a state of mind about ourselves in relation to God and to others. And our tendency, at least for many of us, is, as Romans 12 says, we tend to think more highly of ourselves than we ought to think. And then we tend to think a little less of other people. That is just deeply ingrained in us. Humility, on the other hand, is not to degrade ourselves. It is not to walk around with a long face and comments about how worthless we are. That is not humility. That is often a camouflaged pride. Humility is something that we admire in others. We are attracted to people that are humble. There is something about the presence of a humble person that we enjoy to be around. It is attractive. We like the fruit of humility. But to get to that, true humility, it takes pain. It takes the cross. It takes something that is not easy. It was a choice that Jesus had to make. He was tempted with everything in the world that the devil had to offer him. But in Philippians 2:8, it says that, and being found in fashion as a man, he humbled himself and became obedient unto death, even the death of the cross. And at times, our human flesh just cries out for recognition. In some small way, we want to be noticed. We want to be appreciated. And not all of that, I don't think, is necessarily bad, to be appreciated, to be loved. But you know, Jesus taught in the Sermon on the Mount of the danger of that, that whether we're doing our alms, whether we're praying, whether we're fasting, there's always that temptation to just give those around us a little peek into our lives, to let them know that we're doing this good deed and do you happen to notice me? And when we do that, there is a certain amount of reward, the Bible says. People often do think about, that's a nice guy, he's doing a good thing, she's doing a good thing. So there is a certain amount of reward in that. But Jesus teaches us that don't do that. Don't start down that line of trying to get the praise and glory of man in this life. But do those things before me in your closet. How important is humility? I want to read a little something here. Is humility one of those things that is a good thing to try for? Is it essential to the Christian life? Is it something that hopefully we can attain someday? Little reading here. The infallible proof is talking about humility. The greatest test of whether the holiness we profess to seek or to attain is true, and life will be whether it is manifest, and life will be whether it is manifest in the increasing humility it produces. The one infallible test of our holiness will be the humility before God and man which marks us. Humility is a bloom and beauty of holiness. Humility is the bloom and beauty of holiness. The chief mark of counterfeit holiness is the lack of humility. Every seeker after holiness needs to be on his guard lest unconsciously what was born in the spirit is perfected in the flesh and pride creep in and where its presence is least expected. And it says a little story here. It says a nun who was renowned for her great miracles. The Pope heard of it and sent his servant Philip to report on her witness and work. Bespattered with mud and weary from the long journey, the messenger finally reached his destination and was ushered into the presence of the famous nun. Putting his muddy boot up, he asked her if she would help him with it. Disdainfully, she refused such a humble task. Philip returned to the Pope, saying, "Sir, you need not concern yourself. There is no miracle because there is no humility." And often in our spiritual endeavors, our spiritual talks, our desires to be Christ-like, we think the real test is humility. And it comes back to, like we heard in the devotions, the test is often not in our peer groups and how we're doing and appearing before our friends, but it is often in how we treat the lowly, the misfits in life, the ones that are dirty, the ones that do not seem like they have anything to do with Christ. But it is a test for ourselves. The choice to be humble, to humble ourselves, is a private thing. It is something between that happens between me and God, between you and God. It is the act of humility and holiness are simply a fruit. That nun did not know who that man was. She had no idea what was going on. Her guard was down. And that is how it is when we have fake fruit, fake humility. We can't always know what's going on. And so we misstep at times and the truth comes out. To humble ourselves is a deliberate choice to think properly about ourselves. It is true, though, that sometimes the events of life have a way, if we allow them to get our attention and to reveal how proud we really are. And I had to think of the king Nebuchadnezzar. In Daniel 4, it says, at the end of 12 months, he walked in the palace of the kingdom of Babylon, and the king spake, and this is what he said, "Is not this the great Babylon that I have built for the house of the kingdom by the might of my power and for the honor of my majesty?" But while the word was in the king's mouth, there fell a voice from heaven saying, "O King Nebuchadnezzar, to thee it is spoken, the kingdom is departed from thee." And it goes on to say that rich, wealthy man that had done so much was going to be sent out to the pasture with the cows for 7 years and crawl and eat grass. And in Nebuchadnezzar's life, it got his attention. And it says that he lifted up his eyes to heaven and his understanding returned to him. I think his vision cleared. He seen who he really was again. And God could use him. You know, how important is it, I ask, to be humble? It's not good. We don't usually recommend that we try to rate sins and say that theft is worse than lying or lying is worse than gossip. But Proverbs does say something down that line. He says that there are six things that the Lord hates. Yea, seven are abomination to him. And the very first one is a proud look in those seven things. And it is never because that we are too small that God to use us. But it is rather because we are too big. And another thing I want to read here went very well and very close with some of the thoughts that Will said this morning. It's called a little push downward. And it's a backwards mentality to the way that we as humans think. A story was told in the Christian Herald quite a number of years ago about Dr. Hoffman, who was converted but could not find the peace of mind that he had so desired. One day he asked a minister what the matter was with his spiritual life. The latter was, unfortunately, unable to help him. After that, Dr. Hoffman met a Salvation Army lady worker to whom he told what had happened and asked her to give him a little push upwards. "Doctor," she said, "are you sure you want to push upwards? Do you not think it is a little push downward that you require?" And immediately he felt convicted that she was right. He still had some dark days in his life, but ever found that the thought of a little push downward would always bring him relief. I used to think that God's gifts were on a shelf, one above the other, and that the taller we grew in our Christian character, the easier we could reach them. Now I find that God's gifts are on shelves, one beneath the other, and that it is not a question of growing taller, but of stooping lower, and that we have to go down, always down, to get His best gifts. It's easier said than done. We as humans, especially men, we're builders, we're conquerors, we're climbers. We build things. We build buildings. We build businesses. We build our equity. We build our bank accounts. We build whatever. And we see that in children. My little children, you set up a ladder. You're in a steep area of terrain and kind of almost a cliff. Often children can navigate up. They want to go up. They love to climb. But you just watch a little child and get to the top and they look down. And all of a sudden, to get down is a lot harder than to go up. And it is easier for us to go up, but it is a lot harder for us to go down. Coming down is often the problem. And so it is a conscious choice to humble ourselves. Moving on to verse 11 and 12, I would like to think a little bit about this. And I should say, when I first started this, I was just going to touch on the subject of humility here, because it was just at the end. But as I go through this passage, I see that how the line, the thread of the subjects tie together much more than maybe appear at the beginning. And so as we go into this next subject, I don't think we're leaving humility behind and going forward completely to a different subject. But I do want to change the shift here. It says that in these verses, it talks about speaking evil of our brother and judging our brother. And I'd like to focus especially on the judging part, because in chapter 3 we talked about the tongue, we talked about speech. Life and death are in the power of the tongue and the potential that is there. But I want to touch a little bit on this thought here that James gives. And I am again, it's just interesting to think about, going through James here, how often the thought or the wording of James is similar to his brother and his Lord Jesus Christ in his teaching. on the Sermon on the Mount. And I've thought of this again, and I want to refer to that. I don't know what goes to your mind when we talk about the subject of judging. Now, this is a big subject. You could go down a lot of different avenues with it. And I realize that in our society, as was already mentioned this morning, that the cry for tolerance and the lack of shame is very rampant. Fleshly, unsanctified motives for wanting to live as we please, or they, or whoever it is, without anyone telling us anything, correcting us. And I don't believe at all that this is what James was promoting or teaching here. We as Christians, as followers, do have a responsibility to analyze and have spiritual discernment in making choices in life and make a certain amount of judgment on how to live, and especially as pertains to our lives. But it still does talk and warn here about judging. And I think judging here has a lot to do with the negative condemnation of our brother or our sister. To stand in negative judgment on one another's lives or motives. And I want to bring out the difference here that it says that we are... It talks about speaking evil and judging our brother. They're not necessarily the same thing. We can become a people that can train our tongue to not say the right thing, to not say the thoughts that we think. But what about is going on in our hearts? Where is the judgment? Where is the condemnation level within our hearts? And that is especially the part I would like for us to just consider a little bit here. There is a fleshly side of us as humans that just tends towards criticism, tends towards condemnation towards others, and it can often be under the cloak of spirituality. It can be given in all kinds of ways, spiritual concerns. The tendency to stand in judgment, and in a way all it is to be maybe a little bit of a mini-God, that I make a judgment call on someone else's life. And the thing about judgment often, as you think about the world's Supreme Court or judges, as they pick people, and it's just the nature of being a judge, is that you don't always know all the facts. You don't always know all the motives. You don't always know what really happened. You have pieces of the facts. You know a certain amount of what happened. And you have different people saying different things. So a judge needs to use his best discernment and to try to place motives sometimes and try to assign what happened, even though he don't know for sure what happens. And in Romans 14 dedicates almost a whole chapter to the warning about not judging someone that feels differently about the foods that they eat, about the days that they keep, about some of the details of life. He says, don't do that. Jesus says in Matthew 7, judge not that you be not judged. And he goes on to talk about that. With what judgment you judge, you shall be judged. Why beholdest thou the mote that is in thy brother's eye, but considerest not the beam that is in thine own eye? And I think there's one of the traits of a judgmental, condemning heart is often the blindness to my own faults. We can see so clearly where you're missing it. But it's so hard for me to see what's going on in my life. It's just a trait of a critical spirit. We look outward instead of inward. When we are spending time examining our own selves and being honest with our own faults, it tempers how quick we place judgment on others. What if our judgment is true? What if what I'm saying about you is true? What if I know all the facts? Well, I don't know how you always blend brotherhood accountability, family accountability, with this thought of not judging. I think we do understand, and it's clear in the Bible, that we are, as brothers and churches, have a certain responsibility to be fruit inspectors. If things are done, if sin happens, the Bible spells out that it needs to be dealt with. Sin needs to be called sin. and not covered. But even Jesus, when he was here, the Son of God, perfect in the flesh, he said, if any man hear my words and believe not, I judge him not. You know, I'm not going to condemn you at this point. That is not my job right now. He says, for I came not to judge the world, but to save the world. And I think that is what made Jesus so uniquely attractive. It wasn't that he downplayed sin. It wasn't that he winked at sin. But it was because he did call people to repentance. He did call sin, sin. But he did it without condemnation. One thing I think in this, just the practical side of this, is that the spirit of criticism and a judgmental heart is very hard on relationships. If you think about that, whether it's in our marriage, whether it's in our families, whether it's in the church, whether it's in the workplace. And once we start into that judgmental spirit, there's always an abundance of things to find. It's never ending. You can look at this person's life, you can pick apart that person. You can go on all your life because it's just the way that it is. It's hard to relax. It's hard to trust. It's hard to build, to have fellowship with a group of friends or a family with a father that is constantly criticizing what is going on. It's like a cancer within a body that is always eating and keeping us from prospering and growing, hindering us. It kills, it stifles. Relationships cannot blossom under the atmosphere of condemnation. You know, this subject, I believe, is tied very much with the previous verse of humble yourselves, humble ourselves, and not judging. The devil is the father of pride, and he's also the accuser of the brethren. They often go hand in hand. Romans 14:19 says, you know, what is the answer to this? I think the answer is to humble ourselves. And then I think when there's true humility, there can be a discernment for true, constructive, helping one another. When I truly love my wife, when I'm truly not selfish, when I'm truly don't have a hidden motive or an agenda or ill will in my heart, I can help her with her faults. She can help me with my faults. But when there's selfishness involved, it just causes destruction. Romans 14:19 says, let us therefore follow after the things that make for peace and the things wherewith one may edify. That is on the heels of all the advice to be careful about judging our brothers. I would say, though, before we move on from that, that when a brother and a sister does come to me, come to you, we should be very careful not to try to use this little cliche that is so often used in self-defense, that don't judge me. You're not supposed to judge me. That should be a phrase that we apply to ourselves in relating to other people. But be very quick to apply to other people that have a concern for me. That is often just a deflection of something that maybe is something I need to hear. What is your life is the last part I would like to look at here in James. As we go into verses 13, 14, and 15, James asked this simple, short, thought-provoking question in verse 14. He says, what is your life? And that is a thought I've been thinking about a lot the last week. What is your life? And he goes on to say that it is a vapor that appears for a little time and then it vanishes away. And it is a word picture that any of us can see in our minds. It is something that is simple. It's a simple illustration. It's a time, he's reminding us, to reflect and to put into perspective the brevity of life. That life is fleeting. Life is short. Life is uncertain. We have no promises of how long we have. And earlier in James chapter 1 and in the devotions that Gerald read, it relates to life as a grass or as a flower. And we live in a valley full of grass. And we watch that cycle as the green grass is full of life and moisture and flourishes and grows. And then this time of the year, it's cut off. And just within a few days of warm, windy weather, that grass turns brown, becomes brittle, is dead. It's over. It's done its job. Another season is over. And I was driving up over the mountains in the last week or so, and I stopped up in the cool shade of the mountains by a stream. And there was little, I don't know, daisy flowers, just delicate little flowers growing in the shade of the path there. And I picked one of those, and I thought it was pretty. I thought, well, maybe I could score with my wife and take one back. And I put it in my pickup, and it was a warm day. Went on through the day and was in and out of the pickup. And of course, how pickups get, it's warm. But within a short few hours, that beautiful flower was just wilted and curled and shriveled and dying. And I had to think of that. That is like how our lives are. You know, we are young. We are strong. We are in our prime, and in a very short time, it's over. It dies, the beauty is gone. We're withered. What is our life? Lately, I was reading in 1 Chronicles, and if you read those first chapters, it can be a test of endurance. There's like 10 chapters of genealogies, names. Name after name, descendants of Adam, descendants of Noah, the tribes of Israel. And so I was doing all right, but one morning I was like, I need to read a little more. I'm going to turn to the New Testament. So I turned to Matthew chapter 1, and I began to read. And it says, the book of the generations of Jesus Christ, the son of David, the son of Abraham. Abraham begot Isaac, and Isaac begot Jacob, and Jacob begot Judas and his brethren. And there's another list of genealogies. I thought it was a little bit humorous. But then as I thought of that, I thought about the names packed into that. Name after name after name of people that I do not know, that we do not know hardly anything about. A few of them we do. But all of those names and all of those lives lived and experienced. And I wondered, it made me wonder as I thought of this, what was their life? What happened in their life? Their life of names that I don't even know how to pronounce hardly, was just as real, was just as, meant just as much to them, their experiences, their heartaches, their good times, their mistakes and accomplishments, and all that goes through a person's life. Packed in all down through history. Little lives. And I thought about the picture that life is a vapor. And out of all of those lives, it's just like a puff and a puff and a puff and a puff. Down through the ages, a life. And it's passed. And another one starts. And another one dies out. And another one starts. Life is frail. Life is uncertain. And I think James is just wanting to drive that point home, that we need to remember that when we get out of bed in the morning and we put on our boots and we head out the door, the little insignificant things that we do or do say or maybe don't say can all of a sudden become really big depending on how the day goes in my life or in another person's life. And just within the last week, within the last month, I know of, and you do too, of funerals, of people, of death, of accidents. And in the last week, I know of two different young men. One killed in a motorcycle accident, age 19. Another one, an accident at age 18, survived it. Young men in their prime, where their reaction time, their reflexes, they're in their prime. As good as you're going to get, as fast as you're going to get at age 19, 20, in there. But they were not quick enough. They were not quick enough to dodge some of the circumstances in life that come our way. And neither are any one of us. If it is God's will, we will live tomorrow. If it is God's will, we will finish swathing the field tomorrow. If it is God's will, I will do this or I will do that. In our businesses and makings and deals and wheeling and dealing, we can tend to start thinking we're a pretty big asset to life. We're pretty important. We matter a lot. We got schedules. We got 5 and 10 year business plans. And I'm planning on pouring concrete tomorrow morning at 6:30, if the Lord wills. But I do not know. You do not know. And I think that's okay. I think it's okay to plan. I don't think that James is saying or Jesus is saying do not plan. But he said don't worry about tomorrow. Don't worry about these things. You can plan for them. They may happen. It's good to be prepared. But we're really not that big. And we're really not that smart. And we're really not. The world doesn't revolve around us and our abilities. And another thing, I was picking blueberries earlier this week, TJ's, and the bushes are just full of blueberries. And I just thought about the simple thing as I look at a little blueberry that is as big and important as I am and all that I can do and build and whatever, that I cannot make a blueberry. I have no idea where to start. I can nourish a blueberry bush. I can take what God gives and water it. But for me to go try to just produce a simple blueberry is beyond me. I have no idea. I cannot do that. Let's always remember that the things that we do are not of our own strength, our own boastings, but it is because of God's will, allowing. He gives us free choice. He does allow us to make decisions, accomplish great things at times. But it is only if He wills or allows it. And you see that spirit of humility being touched on again here, the importance of that. It says, you rejoice in your boastings. All such rejoicing is evil. When we boast of the things that we're going to do. What is our life? Sometimes we feel maybe insignificant. We feel like, as I look at my life, 40 years of what have I accomplished? What have I done? Have I done anything? Have I been faithful? Am I fulfilling what God put me on earth to do? And those are questions that I think we should think about, questions that we should be challenged by, allow to God to work in our lives and to change things in our lives. But I do want to say that sometimes we worry that we are not doing great things for God and that our life is uneventful and insignificant in the kingdom of God. Maybe you're just a mother that is taking care of children, that up at night, packing lunches, running boys here and there, taking care of your husband, or a young person that is just trying to figure out what to do with life. Maybe teach school here, get a job there, helping your mom and your dad. And fathers, we're struggling or running around paying our bills and trying to raise a family and to help others as we come along in life. I would just say that I don't think we need to feel guilty about some of the mundane things in life. I think that is that can be pride. That can be a trap. We should not become complacent. We should not become lethargic in our Christian life, but we need to be content with what God has given us, the path that we are walking, the place that we have found ourselves in. Yes, be open to being led somewhere else and to serve and go and give up. That's all part of it. But when we are being faithful and serving the Lord in our little quiet corner, in our little humble way, I believe that we are not wasting our lives. And you think of the Bible, those are the stories that get attention, the popular stories, the stories of faithful men and women in the Bible. And when we read them, we maybe feel it's a little bit like looking at Facebook. I don't look at Facebook, but what I say, and everybody else is doing something neat and exciting and just really has it together. And you kind of, I've heard that people look at that and they walk away a little bit depressed. Just like, my life is pretty boring. It's not much going on. And I think if we look at the Bible in the wrong way, we can do the same thing. We can look at all the men and women of God and the magnificent things and great things that they accomplished. And I am a nothing and I am doing nothing. But if you think about those men's lives, that Moses did a few miracles by God's help. 40 years in the desert, nothing. Doing, probably seeing very few people. 40 years before that, the first 80 years of his life, just learning to know God, learning to be content possibly. Noah spent 500 years before he went down in history as doing anything significant. It says that he was a righteous man, faithful for 500 years. Finally, God had a project for him to do. And the details of Esther and Ruth, we don't know all that. Jesus spent 90% of his life behind the scenes. I don't know what he did. Maybe he swept his dad's shop and washed his mom's dishes and just helped in ways that were insignificant. But I believe he was faithful. He chose to be humble and to be faithful in the little things. All the faithful men and women that did great things, I think, first were faithful to God in passing the little tests of life. So if we find ourselves just doing the duties of a mother or a father, that's fine, but be a godly mother. And if we're a young person struggling with purpose, just be the best helper, be the best person, be a godly young person. And as fathers, if we be godly examples to our families in the details of life, we are not wasting our lives. It is very significant. What is your life? It is a vapor that appears for a little time, soon vanishes away. We do not know how much vapor we have left. We don't know if it's a half a day, if it's a half a decade, we don't know. But let's remember when we get up in the morning, when we start another day, start another week, if the Lord wills, we will do this and we will do that. God bless you. That is all I have. Earl, I meant to ask if you could